We hope you enjoy this episode. If you do, please subscribe on iTunes and don't forget to rate and review us. It helps other people find the podcast too. Also, tell your friends. You can follow us on Twitter at HOC Podcast. And please, please do get involved in the discussion, preferably as politely as possible. Thank you very much. You're listening to House of Comments, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Jo Swinson, who is Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrat Party, and we're here particularly to talk about her recent book, which is called Equal Power and How You Can Make It Happen. Hello, Jo.
Hi, Emma. Good to be with you. And good to be hello, you. Everyone that's listening to House of Comments.
Absolutely. All three of you. So, I mean, the first obvious question is, why this book? Why now?
It's nearly been 3 years in the making. So my first idea to write it came shortly after the general election when I lost my seat. And I suppose I was, I both wanted to continue changing the world. And I also was reflecting on my experience in government where I was a business minister and also had ministerial responsibility for women. And I felt like I'd learned a significant amount in that role about how gender equality works, how it's all joined up, that we think about things like the gender pay gap and violence against women and media sexism as if these are different things. And I just, you know, had this view of it through that role in government, of seeing how it is all linked. And also I knew the limitations of government. And that, I mean, you can argue about whether there should be more resources for the Government Equalities Office. Yes, there should. There's about 50 civil servants and a budget of, at the time, it was about £20 million a year. So it's a tiny, tiny amount of what the government does. But even if you increased that tenfold, government would never be able to solve this problem on its own. Because unlike many of the other things I dealt with in government, gender inequality is so much more ingrained through centuries in our culture. And so we need cultural solutions to that as well. And that, in my view, means that we need people in their everyday individual lives to do things differently, to start to change the way that we think about gender.
I mean, I noticed in the book, every chapter ends with some quite practical recommendations.
I do like a to-do list.
I'm fully on board with that. You should see how I've organised. I'm currently doing an MA and I have marches tasks laid out on sheets of paper everywhere. The recommendations do skew much more heavily towards individual or group action than government action. That's clearly a deliberate choice.
Indeed. And there's lots of things I think government should do. And I allude to some of those in the book. But my purpose in writing the book is very much to try to empower people who are reading it, most of whom will not be members of parliament, members of the government. And so it's about saying to people, other people have responsibility too, but there are things you can do in your everyday life. And rather than feeling gender equality is too huge an issue, what could I possibly do about it? Actually, here's some really practical steps. And even taking one or two small actions is part of a difference. Because if everybody that reads the book does a few extra things, that brings gender equality closer.
Yeah, absolutely. And so where do you see the role of politicians like yourself in leading or promoting non-governmental actions?
Well, it's interesting. I think it is important. And I certainly found with some of the issues I was dealing with in government that it was a way in which government and I suppose politics more generally, politicians who have a platform, have a power. They have a convening power to bring people together and bash heads together. They have a power to get issues on the kind of wider public agenda. And, you know, way back in 2009-10, when I started campaigning on body image issues, you know, that again was about putting that out there as a political issue, which it hadn't been considered as before. And I think that is an important role. In fact, if you go back beyond, you know, before that, you know, I was campaigning on issues like excess packaging, which is now very much an issue of the day with the whole focus on plastics. But I think that is something politicians can do. And I found in government, you know, you couldn't always get agreement to spend money, particularly in the coalition days. you know, in straitened economic times, that's quite a difficult way for government to make impact. You can do things by changing the law, and I think that definitely legal changes have a role to play. And, you know, we introduced shared parental leave, gender pay gap reporting. I made sure that we got that secured through a legal change for all that the Conservatives now like to claim credit for it. You know, they did resist it for 5 years and then finally caved to us when I saw the opportunity. But legal changes on their own don't do it. And I mean, shared parental leave would be a good example. The cultural side of that is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And I think government can lead. They can encourage companies to change policies, to do more in changing workplace culture. And bluntly, particularly when you're a minister, you have that ability that people care about what you say so much more, particularly in the sector in which you're operating. And so I think that's a kind of softer power of government that in some cases is underrated, but I found pretty effective.
So, I mean, as much as making those instrumental changes, there are cultural changes, but would you agree that it probably needs a mixture of both?
Absolutely. I think sometimes legislative change is a bit of a blunt instrument, and it's interesting. To maybe use the example of body image, or you know, the advertising and media imagery. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do in government that I was blocked from doing was a review on media sexism, to get an esteemed person from the media industry to lead a review of media sexism. I mean, that would be a typical area where you're not going to probably recommend a change in the law. I mean, you know, we had Leveson and there were some important changes there. But it's not really for politicians to tell the media what to do. But you can help shine a spotlight on what are undoubtedly some very serious issues in the way that women are portrayed, and therefore encourage the media itself to have more awareness. And again, on body image, you know, encouraging the advertising industry to take more of a lead themselves. The Advertising Standards Authority has massively changed its position compared to 2010. And, you know, recently they launched a big inquiry into gender stereotyping in ads, which they would never have done had it not been for that public pressure. So I think legislation's great, but it's also what is it best for? And sometimes it's never going to keep pace with what needs to happen. And if you can skin the cat another way, then why not do that?
I mean, going back to the body image question, it was really interesting. I was struck by a line in your book, which I think you were quoting somebody else, which said that most eating disorders start with a diet.
Yeah.
And that really, I mean, that struck me quite interesting, because I've had a long sort of question in my mind about whether we treat obesity disorders differently from what are currently grouped as eating disorders. Because I wouldn't say that obesity does necessarily start from a diet. And we very rarely talk about the mental health aspects of obesity, much more about cheap, fast food.
Yeah.
Would you agree that we treat those two things differently?
Well, massive caveat, I'm not a medical expert. But I mean, we did, when we did the all-party parliamentary inquiry into body image, that particular line came from one of the academics who deals with eating disorders. And it really struck me. And, you know, the whole point was not everyone that goes on a diet gets an eating disorder, but that is a very common starting point for the people who are more susceptible to have an eating disorder. And the other concept, which Susie Orbach talks a lot about, is, you know, there's eating disorders, which, you know, we have specific medical definitions for, but there's also this wider issue of disordered eating, which I think is where perhaps more of the obesity stuff also comes in. That's where things like comfort eating is part of that. And of course, the mental health link to that is very significant. And the other stuff around obesity and sort of body image is one of the biggest barriers that people who are overweight will talk about in terms of exercising, is how they'll look, how people will perceive them if they go for a run or if they go to the gym. And so, you know, sometimes when I would be doing interviews on these issues, people would say, oh, well, you know, you're campaigning against eating disorders, but we've got an obesity problem, you know, surely. As if making fat people feel crap about themselves was going to be some solution to obesity. Do you know what? We have tried that one to destruction. There is a lot of making fat people feel crap about themselves. Actually, if you can make people feel good about themselves, and that's not about saying you don't put out important public health messages about what healthy weights are and so on, but it is about not having fat shaming. And it is also, I think, about recognising, I mean, even there's some interesting discussion about whether BMI is too blunt a tool. Certainly, if you look at a very fit rugby player, you know, he'll typically be obese on a BMI rating. So it's, you know, it's a tool as part of a wider range of things. And, you know, many doctors will say it's much better to be a bit overweight and to be very fit and take a lot of exercise than to be, you know, absolutely on the bang on what the apparently perfect weight is going to be, but never being active and physically... you know, physically active and healthy in those ways. So I think encouraging people to enjoy their bodies and finding the ways in which it makes them feel good, and it will be different for different people, is an important part of dealing with obesity.
No, I mean, I think that absolutely. I mean, I have struggled with my weight my whole life. I've lost 10 stone, six wow. through an operation and four in the last year through a slimming world. And it's a virtuous circle, but the 25 years where I wasn't in that virtuous circle, people being rude to me didn't help in the slightest.
Probably just made you more likely to want to go and eat something.
Some bad chicken sandwiches or what have you. And I think that we just have this, you know, I think there is a real dichotomy in the way that we treat people who are too thin and people who are too fat, and we treat them very differently. But I think a lot of it stems from quite similar mental health issues, opting out of certain aspects of your body and your bodily life. And I think that could be much better explored, and that may be something where as a politician, as someone in the public eye, and particularly with, you know, the stuff that you've done with the APPG, and I know obviously now that you're a very senior party leader, you can't always run an APPG, but still these are issues that can be brought in and brought through leadership like yourself. And before we started recording, you were talking about how your current pregnancy, congratulations.
Thank you.
Is actually helping you to address your own body image issues.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's... I wouldn't say I've got particularly negative body image, but I kind of think like everyone, you know, you look and you compare with what you see, and I'm really struck by how in pregnancy... You know, I'll sometimes do that thing where I'll be posing for a photograph and I realise I'm kind of doing that thing where you, like, hold your stomach in and I'm like, really, what is the point? I'm pregnant, you know, it's not doing anything. But the point is that you're in that sort of mindset more generally. But when pregnant, of course, the pregnant bodies that we see all look pregnant. Now, okay, sometimes it'll be celebrities who look just absolutely amazing. But I think because more of the pregnant bodies that we see in visual imagery in the public eye are actually more attainable because they are pregnant bodies, then it just feels like, yeah, I look exactly how I'm supposed to look. I'm pregnant, I'm growing a person, this is absolutely right. And therefore, the thought doesn't even cross your mind to think about whether, you know, whether your bump looks big in this. Well, yeah, it does. I mean, you know, because you're pregnant. So I'm always struck by that. And I think the other thing is I've found through both my pregnancies is the sort of awareness of what your body's doing and that awe. Like, the human body is a really amazing thing. And pregnancy really, you know, reminds you of that. The way that your body just knows what to do. And you kind of read the books about what it's managing to do in terms of creating fingernails and eyelashes and organs. So I think that also helps you to connect with your body in a different way that is not about how does it look. It's about actually what is this body achieving and doing. So I've always quite enjoyed pregnancy from that perspective.
I'm going to a different end of the scale. I mean, you talk, you have a whole chapter on men and boys and what is currently being in the in vogue terms toxic masculinity and the effect that gender norms have on men and boys as much as on women. How you and I both self-identified with the Joan Cox phrase massive feminist. How can we ensure that as massive feminists we are helping men and boys?
Well, I think that gender equality impacting on men and boys being part of the feminist debate is important. And I mean, there's individuals I interviewed for my book who take slightly different views on this and who I wouldn't agree with about everything in sort of feminist terms, but who nonetheless have some important things to say about men and boys. And I suppose the line I would use is gender inequality is typically really bad for women. In most ways that gender inequality manifests itself, it's women and girls that get the rough end of the stick. But there are some areas where actually it really negatively impacts on men and boys as well. And so that's why I spoke in the International Men's Day debate this year, and why I think that's a good debate to have. Because I think we do need to raise these issues. And actually, I think, you know, let's be honest also, some of the men that are MPs have perhaps failed in their duty to call some of this stuff out. And the reason I sort of posit for that is I don't think they almost see these gendered issues, because I think if you're male, then gender is so much more invisible to you as a concept, because it sort of doesn't cross your mind because you're the default already. So I think particularly around issues around mental health, particularly around issues around parenting, the sort of defaults tend to favour women. And so that can be as simple as, you know, if you've got a male friend who's about to become a dad, you know, not sort of making assumptions that his wife's going to do everything and he's not going to care about it if they're in the workplace, you know, not just assuming it's all going to be business as usual. You know, if you're a mum going to mother and toddler group and a solitary dad turns up, you know, actually just having that empathy to think, how does that feel? It probably feels a bit like when I'm the only woman in the room in the workplace. So making that extra effort to be welcoming. I've spoken to dads who've sort of said that after the rhyme time or whatever the thing is that they're at, some of the women have all just gone off for a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know if I'm invited. I don't know if I should ask. I don't know if I'm not welcome. And so all of those sort of uncertainties about the norms, we are really, as women, used to in other professional lives. So just having that thought process about men in those situations, I think, is really important. And similarly, in terms of men talking about how they feel, you know, they might not, because they have not been brought up in the same way, have all of the language or feel as comfortable with it. So perhaps that's a way in which we can also help sometimes.
One of the things that struck me was that in that chapter, one of your recommendations was to join a union. I think that the reason it was in that chapter was particularly because you talk about health and safety issues. But it was quite interesting because obviously I, as a woman and a trade unionist, I would suggest that everybody joins a union. So I'm interested in your thought process behind putting that recommendation particularly in that chapter.
I mean, that's exactly the reason for it. Obviously, the health and safety at work was also another area where, you know, men are much more likely to die in the workplace. And somehow it's almost, you know, is it just seen as a hazard of you know, working in agriculture or construction? And, you know, the numbers have been falling, which is great. But of course, unions are really important in promoting health and safety. But clearly, on issues like pregnancy discrimination or the problems that women face in the workplace, the fact that more people who are on low incomes, low pay, are women, then yes, absolutely. I think trade unions have a much wider role to play. And I think it's sad the way the debate in this country has, particularly under this government, and they always try to do this in the coalition government, it was one of the biggest sort of tension points between the Lib Dem and Conservative sides in coalition, and as Employment Relations Minister, I was sort of in the middle of that. But this sort of obsession with, you know, somehow there being a problem with trade unions, when you look at the evidence and the number of strike days are significantly lower than they have been, and the relationships are generally very positive, and okay, you do get occasional times where it doesn't work. But those are quite exceptional. The norm is trade unions are really positive, and therefore I find that problematic. So I did want to have the recommendation in there.
I mean, I used to work at the TUC, full disclosure, and we did some work. I was working in their adult education section.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the relationship in Germany, which has much higher productivity than we do, it's a real tripartite, you know, system where business and government and unions work together rather than seen as constantly in conflict.
Yes, I mean, then lots of European countries have that kind of social partnership model. I mean, I would say I don't think we should be exclusive about it. I think there's other ways. There's kind of, you know, worker councils, there's employee ownership. I think there's lots of ways of involving workers, and unions should be one way of doing that. I'm a massive fan of Frances O'Grady. I think she is a superb leader of the union movement. And she took on her role very shortly after I was appointed minister, actually. So I remember one of our early meetings where we really started to get on really well. But yeah, so I think generally the case for people at work being engaged in what they do is so significant, particularly in the light of our low productivity as a nation, that it is a crying shame that it is not more widely recognised as a route to improve efficiency of businesses.
Coming back to the book, there have been quite a few sort of books by female MPs recently. That may just be a symptom of the fact that a certain number of female MPs have reached a certain point in their career. There was Harriet Harman's autobiography, Jess Phillips' Every Woman. How do you think your approach is the same as theirs? How do you think it differs?
So I think, I would always encourage people to read lots of these books. I mean, I think mine is specifically focused on action and what can you do? So I've tried, I think Harriet's is much more of a memoir generally, and chronicling really important life in politics, actually, because Harriet's time in Parliament as the mother of the House, has spanned a time when there were hardly any women MPs to a time where, nearly a third of MPs are women, which is amazing. And Harriet has always been such a strong supporter of women in the House in all parties. So I think actually what were her experiences are from a historical perspective, incredibly important and give an insight into a side of the story that doesn't always get told. So I think that's the sort of the role that book plays. And obviously Jess is a great feminist campaigner, and I'm delighted that she's in the House. I think that's, it's brilliant. And so, she's got a very different style of writing, for example.
And I think Helen Lewis described it as being stuck next to her on a bus, but in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think my book is trying to sort of say, look, this is what I learned about gender equality and the sort of causes and the roots of it. From being Minister for Women, and more importantly, what can we all do about it? Because I think there is a real energy in the feminist movement at the moment, and I'm so delighted by it, and I could see some of that really starting when I was the minister, and organisations like UK Feminista started to get off the ground maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and more and more of these kind of conferences. You've got the Women of the World Festival that's now been going many years, but this energy really is palpable. But how do we challenge it is my sort of question, because it's really easy and we all do it. We shout at the telly, we shout at the radio, we get frustrated with what we see. But I think we're starting to see with things like the Me Too movement, it being channeled and people coming together. So I think people can do things individually, and I also think there's strength in numbers.
In the book, you describe you've been on quite a journey in terms of all women shortlists.
I have.
It's quite interesting because you described your reasons for opposing them possibly in more depth than your reasons for having changed your mind. So
yeah.
I was wondering if you could expand on that.
And I've written some blog posts on sort of changing my mind, some of which go into the intricacies of Liberal Democrat politics, which perhaps were less interesting to the general reader.
Our listeners. We love the
exactly.
in-wing stuff.
So it is quite a pragmatic reason. I opposed a woman shortlist because I felt, and I still believe, there are other ways of doing it if you have proper leadership within a party. I never opposed them for the Labour Party, and I don't mean that in a sort of patronising way. I think if the problem is you have sexism in the selection process, i.e. a man and a woman going for selection have a different chance of being selected, I don't see how you can resolve that without something like a woman shortlists. In most employment circumstances, you would hope to do that through you have employment law, and ultimately people can take a tribunal case, imperfect though that is, but you can't do that in a selection because it's just everybody voting. Whereas in the Lib Dems, what we found when we looked at the research in 2001 is a man and a woman were equally likely to get selected. So it was a different problem to what the Labour Party had, and I believed it could be solved differently. And I worked very hard to try and solve it differently. And I still think it is technically possible to do that. But I suppose what I overestimated was the willingness of others, particularly in leadership roles in the party, and I mean that in the widest sense. So I mean people as local party chairs and officers, as well as obviously in the sort of official leadership, to really take action and prioritise this. People were very exercised about not having all women shortlists. That was quite easy to get people signed up to, but to get them as excited about implementing the alternative solution was harder. So I sort of overestimated that, and on some of the blogs and in the speech that I made to conference, I was quite clear about some of the shocking things that happened. So I set up the Gender Balance Task Force. It became the Campaign for Gender Balance. Did amazing work. We did do pretty well at getting women selected in target seats. But one of the big problems we identified was incumbency. Mm. So there were certain seats that we were likely to win. As Liberal Democrats, we have this obsession with localism, which I also think we need to challenge a little bit. But that means that, bluntly, you're pretty unlikely to get selected for a seat if you don't have a very strong local connection, which makes it even more important that you have candidates that are good women candidates in those seats. And so I did the analysis of our existing sitting MPs and how many approved candidates were women in each of those. I printed it on a piece of paper. I booked a slot at the parliamentary party meeting. I explained this, that in most cases it was zero, in a few cases it was one or two. And I said, what we want you to do, there's a tear-off slip at the bottom of this piece of paper, write down the names of three women in your constituency who you think would be good candidates. We will do the rest. We will make contact with them, we'll invite them to training events, we'll give them support. You can give me this slip at the end of this meeting, you can put it in my pigeonhole, you can put it in the internal mail, you can email me. That's all I want you to do. And I did this at the beginning of a boring meeting. I thought, gives them something to do during the meeting. And of all of my colleagues, of whom there were about 60, less than a third responded. So even when you were asking somebody to do something so simple, that was the level of engagement. And I just, you know, and I mean, that's not obviously the only thing we did, but that's probably one of the most telling examples of how hard it was to really get movement on the issue and to make people do the things they needed to do to talent spot. And so instead they would advertise a seat and they would go, oh well, no woman applied. And you go, well, who did you ask? And did you ask them a year ago so that they had time to go through the approval process? So that was my my rationale for changing my mind, was that you had to force people to take those actions.
Yeah, there are quite a few other places where you're quite keen on some quota systems. I mean, you talk about parliamentary media passes.
Yeah, yeah.
And also attached and making short money dependent on a certain amount of gender balance.
So I think, I think it's better if you get the buy-in and it's done through leadership. And so I would start with targets, but then have the kind of threat of quotas. I think the threat of quotas is incredibly powerful. So I found on the Women on Boards agenda when we were doing that, and we made significant progress in government on this with Vince's leadership and Mervyn Davis as well, and I think having men really prioritising it is unfortunately perhaps very important to success too. But as well as all the great stuff we were doing through the Davies Review and Helena Morrissey's 30% Club, there was also this European legislation at the same time that was threatening that we might end up having quotas imposed by Europe. And so the business community understood that if we could show that we could do it, it made the case to resist that legislation from Europe so much stronger. So it was like, almost like a pincer movement, and it was really successful. But you need to keep that focus up. And of course, when the focus dropped, then ultimately went after the 2015 election, then, you know, the progress stalled as well. So I think on, you know, the parliamentary media passes, you know, I think, yeah, first of all, publish the data and see what happens. But then ultimately, yeah, it may well be that you decide to move to a quota system. And so, but the first step is actually collecting the information and putting it out there in black and white, because often people are surprised by how bad it is. Yeah. They assume it's better. We're finding this with gender pay gap reporting all the time. You've got companies running around really worried that in a couple of weeks' time they've got to publish data that is going to make them look really bad, because they thought it was all fine because they'd had some warm words in a corporate report a couple of years ago.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's like the statistics on people speaking up in meetings.
Yes.
You know, people think that women speak.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that my podcasting partners think I speak more than I do, because yeah, I've heard them talk about it.
Exactly.
And it is extraordinary, because I speak as much as they do. And,
exactly.
And but in any meeting, if a woman speaks 25% of the time, she's considered to have spoken 50%.
Exactly. Exactly. And it is this, you know, the ability for women to take up space is still contested.
Yeah.
And they are still viewed to take up more space than they actually do. So that is one of the problems. And therefore, counting, I'm a big fan of counting. Counting really helps you understand where you're actually at.
Yeah, absolutely. The Liberal Democrats, like all Westminster parties, are a bit of a coalition.
Yeah.
And this is... and Mark will never forgive me if I didn't say this is probably a result of a lack of a first past the post and a lack of electoral reform.
There, yeah,
Mark, you can
very good
set off our klaxon. But you speak in the book quite directly to, I think, probably the classic liberal side of the party and say, particularly on freedom of speech, is that we actually address, say, hey, Liberals, how do you think this is working out for you? There is obviously that tension between the sort of classic Liberal and social Liberal, social Democrats, sort of wings of your party. Now that you're deputy leader, you presumably have to talk to and for both sides of that. How do you manage that?
Well, I mean, I think it is overstated a bit quite how different it is. And I think there have been times in our party's history where that has been more pronounced, sort of different groups within the party. And I think it's fair to say that during coalition, that was a more obvious difference as well. Whereas now it does feel like we're probably the most united of the parties. So I think there is a real... I think there is a real unity and sense of purpose, but obviously you do always have people who've got different emphasis on things. I mean, I'm very clear that we protect freedoms and we're about focusing on the individual, but particularly the looking at things through an equality lens makes it very clear that there's things, and this is part of liberalism, that there's things that you have to do in order that people can actually take up opportunities. I mean, the classic example is everybody's free to read a book if you're not prevented from doing so, but if you don't know how to read, you can't read the book. So I would say equality comes in a similar vein. You know, we also need to make sure that through the state and indeed through our own actions, and in a political party, that's also about how do we actually reach out and become inclusive, that we are making it possible for everybody to genuinely achieve their opportunities and what their aspirations are. So I don't think there needs to be a conflict, but I do think sometimes you just need to frame those issues in that way so that it is understood as a Liberal issue.
Absolutely. In the book, you talk about standing up, being counted, grabbing the opportunities. So I have to ask the obvious question. Why didn't you run for leader?
Probably the shortest and simplest answer is I didn't want to. Which I think, by the way, is a pretty good reason. It's and when I say I didn't want to, I thought about it very seriously. I analysed it. I thought about it from all the different aspects of my life. And my instinct was just confirmed with all of those sort of analysis and sort of tests I put it through in conversations that I had. You know, this was not something I wanted to do last June. And so I took that decision. And the fact that I felt so much better once I'd taken the decision and written the blog about it just totally, again, reinforced that I'd done the right thing. And so I think it's a job that if you're going to go for it, you need to know exactly what you want to do with it. And you need to be 110% up for it. And so I suppose the feeling I had when Theresa May called the election on the 18th of April, and I can remember it vividly, and it took me about a heartbeat to realise that I wanted to stand, and I was absolutely, I am doing this, I'm going to win back East Dubartonshire for the Liberal Democrats, this is what I need to do, and this is how I'm going to do it, this is what I'm going to do with it. That is the feeling I would want to have, that burning passion, if I was to take on the leadership role at some point. And so I think, that's not where I was. So
in the book, you're quite hard on yourself about your role in the Lord Renard affair. You're quite self-critical, and you go into it in some detail. You also talk about, quite sort of glancingly, some inaction, particularly from Danny Alexander, where there was a meeting that wasn't held. And you don't seem to be quite so critical of him and Nick. Is that just a woman thing?
I don't know. I mean, I've probably spent more time contemplating and reflecting on my own actions than elements that were frustrating at the time. I also wrote, as well as obviously writing about this in the book, I also separately wrote quite a long Medium blog post about it, because I think that we do need to reflect on how we do these things. And I think, in seeing lots of organisations going through these machinations now, I understand I feel like I've got a good insight into what's happening in the organisations, because there's the sort of understandable instinct to sort of protect the organisation. And often what do you do? Like in this case, when it's the chief executive, who is their boss? My goodness, well, who? And then you get into this sort of political scenario. You go, well, is it this person who might be able to have an influence on them? And I mean, the other thing that I reflected, that which is part of the wider thing, particularly when you're talking about stuff which is within the political sphere, you have to understand what the fallout would be, and what, you know, for the individuals involved. Mm. Because if you're talking about major political figures, as we saw with Kate Maltby and Damian Green, then you yourself can become a target. And there's a limit to what protection that you can give. And so the other reason I actually felt quite, it was a difficult situation, was that I was sort of, there were people who were friends of mine, and I'm kind of feeling about how should I advise them as a friend? And then there's also, how do I advise them as, you know, one of the party's MPs? And, you know, and I was, you know, I was an MP, I was, you know, elected to Parliament, but I think I was, you know, pretty much the most junior MP in the House of Commons. I was 27 years old, 28 years old. And, you know, to say sort of the power that I had within the party, you know, was not very significant. So I was sort of feeling my way through it. So I suppose I have thought back quite often about that and thought, you know, what could I have done differently? And it was very difficult at the time. And, you know, I tried to do what I thought was right. We did make sure action was taken. So, I mean, I was absolutely determined that that happened. And, you know, Chris Rayner did lose his job as chief executive, ultimately. But it was obviously very unsatisfactory. And the party's processes have significantly improved. But I still wouldn't put my hand up and say, well, it's obviously perfect. And I think sometimes there's a sort of... Still, I see, even through doing this cross-party working group with the other parties in Parliament, that there's sometimes this instinct from parties to say, well, of course, our process is really good. And I just feel like going, let's just stop being so we're great at this and just recognise that this is hard. Actually, whatever process, and we're debating it as it happens this afternoon, and I think we have come up with a good independent complaints process, but we will implement it. And it will be used, and there'll be things that are found that don't work. And that's why we've built in a review process, because you need to keep responding and changing and understanding what can be done better. And, you know, when you do have a victim that then feels badly treated, you need to listen to them, you need to understand what needs to change. And I think, I just think in politics, the sort of defence mechanism is so automatic. Mm-hmm. Whereas what this really needs is... is actually a bit of humility, which is hard again within political space, because you don't often get given the space for that, either for individuals who genuinely want to repent, if you like, and we need to make space for people who are genuine about that, because bluntly, as we know as women, there are so many occasions where so many men have, you know, at some point in their life crossed a line. But there needs to be space for people to understand from the other person's perspective. So I do think this is still a difficult issue to be dealt with, because you're trying to make sure you're looking at it from the victim's perspective, or the person who's experienced the harassment. They don't all want to consider themselves to be victims, and that's totally fair enough. But it's not easy, and you don't necessarily have all the things in your control to make sure that you get the outcome that they want.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. We are recording this about a week before it will go out, so we're going to put it out for International Women's Day.
Oh, lovely.
Roughly. But the Labour 2 report has come out today.
Yeah.
And when the Reynolds crisis was happening, I'm a Labour person, and that's my role on this podcast, but I was very cautious to be absolutely conscious of not making my criticisms of what was happening within the Lib Dems a tribal thing.
Yeah.
And I can be as tribal as anybody else can, and the tribalism is part of the problem, because we do protect our own, often, well, the powerful of our own. I wrote a blog about Monica Lewinsky's political career. Yeah, she must have been so bright to get an internship at the White House, and yet, you know, we lost out on all of that potential future because... the man was protected because he was more important.
Of course, of course.
And yeah, this has happened in all parties, in all cultures, in all, you know, lots of, across the world. So it's very important that we don't try to make this, oh, well, Labour's good and Lib Dems are bad, or vice versa.
It was really interesting at the time when it was all, not when it was all happening, because it sort of came to light some years later, but when all of that did come to light in the public domain, the reaction from Labour women MPs was really interesting. A lot of quiet comments of people coming up to me and saying, we can tell, we know you did everything you could. Because, and the reason that they said that, and with feeling, it was pretty clear to me, was that, because they'd also tried to push the levers in their own party and come up against these brick walls sometimes.
Yeah, and I think also some of the criticism of you was gendered, because there was this expectation that you, as the woman, should have done more. It's like the Meryl Streep, Harvey Weinstein problem. Well, she wasn't abusing people.
Yeah.
Why are you talking about Meryl Streep when we should be talking about Harvey Weinstein? Why are you talking about Joe Swinson when we should be talking about Chris Renard?
Well, and I mean, it is... I mean, that wasn't lost on me, but there's no point sort of going on about as someone involved, and that's why I've really reflected on, actually, you know, what could I do differently? And I think we all should be reflecting on that, but I think you're right that men should be reflecting on that as much as women should.
Absolutely. And I think that was the point that struck me, was that you were being very self-reflective and self-critical, which is absolutely part of the process that we should all go through. But then also, I would like to hear the same sense of reflection from the men that were involved, and not just Lord Renard, who does not seem to have been very reflective at all.
No, exactly. And that's what is still so painful about the whole thing, because, and that's where I say, actually, if you can create space for people to understand when they've done something wrong and to make, you know, genuine apology, it doesn't make the thing go away, but I think actually it helps to give some closure to the people that have gone through it. I mean, you know, obviously you don't want to go through it in the first place, but that what has happened has been the opposite of that, which is what makes me so furious, because it is actually subjected the people that experienced that to feel that they can't stay in the party, that they feel that they've been traduced and their reputations undermined, and it really does make my blood boil.
Okay, well, on a lighter note, if you were going to ask that somebody who's read this book was going to take away one thing, maybe a woman and a man, what would that one thing be?
To a woman who's read the book, the one thing would be take some action. Do something. You can have an impact on this. And so choose whatever it is. I mean, it doesn't actually almost matter. Choose the thing you care about the most, the thing that you can do most easily, and start doing something. And then pass the book on to somebody else, so that creates a virtuous chain. And to a man, I mean, I suspect that for some men reading the book, some of what they read will be familiar, but other stuff might not be, and it might be new. And so I would just encourage men to be... the first thing would just be to be aware of gender and to be aware of the occasions when it actually gives you privilege, and to be a man, and also to take action. But I think that awareness is the sort of step that I want men to start with. Perhaps in a similar way, I mean, I just sort of hesitate to make comparisons, but I would love it if a man picked up Equal Power and felt even a fraction of what I felt having picked up Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race.
Oh, absolutely. Which, fantastic book.
It's an amazing book by Rainey Edward Lodge. And I just realised, my goodness, how much do I not know about racism?
Yeah.
But I now feel like I know a bit more. And I also know I need to listen more. And I can do some of that. And so I suppose I want, you know, racism and sexism aren't exactly the same thing, but there's clearly some parallels. And I want men to start understanding a bit more, without expecting them to, you know, automatically understand it all as you know, those that have lived as a woman would understand it.
Great. Thank you very much. And so, final question, what's next?
What's next? Well, we're trying to stop Brexit. 2018 is pretty key for that. In just about, you know, 3 and a bit months' time, then, you know, a new feminist will be born, and I'll be spending a bit of time looking after baby and developing that bond, as will my husband, obviously. And the other thing, I suppose, is I'm really trying to, on the politics, kind of work through what are the... I think Brexit's a symptom. What are the things that led to Brexit, and how can we find more radical policy answers on a kind of liberal platform, progressive platform, that respond to those concerns? And I think that's quite a big piece of work. Not expecting it'll all be done in the next 3 months, but that's where my focus is, really, because I think there's so much that's worrying for me about the way the country's going, the division in society, the disconnect, the issue between the generations, the future of work, the lack of focus on how the world is changing. And so I think that sort of policy development and focus is something which I'm really quite excited about getting stuck into.
Great, lovely. Well, Jo Swinson, thank you so much for coming on House of Commons today. And I'd just like to finish by thanking Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.